The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Just keep those comments rolling in, and hopefully we can get to more of them as the week unfolds here. Well, we have a lot to get to. On today's program, we'll be talking about the changing face of London, something that a few of us noticed during our recent visit to the British Museum and Hyde Park just last week. And we'll be following on, too, with more discussion on the migrant crisis in Europe. It's not making as many headlines as it did last year, but the problem still persists. And it's leading to, as we know, it's leading to some dramatic changes on the continent, that's for sure. There's also quite a few stories out today about President Obama's alarming wish to ban America's first nuclear strike strategy. And even as the rest of the world is out there rearming, this administration in Washington forges ahead with its naive plan to build a world without nuclear weapons. Also, just yesterday it was announced, I think it came out from the Pentagon, that 15 more Guantanamo detainees were being released, which brings that prison's population down to 61. The president here, again, forges ahead with his plan to empty out Guantanamo and to basically denuke the United States, to reduce the United States' nuclear arsenal, and to change its policies, long-established policies. And when we get to that story about banning the America's first nuclear strike, you'll see what kind of reaction there has been to President Obama's desire to do so. First, this piece here from Commentary Magazine. It's about the Palestinian tactic of going out and killing a Jew, and how that ISIS is using this same strategy in Europe. Instead of going and killing a Jew, though, it's kill a Westerner, kill a European. It says here, well, just to set it up a little bit before I give the quote, it's talked about how long the West basically has just turned a blind eye to this Palestinian culture that encourages young men to go out, as I say, and to kill a Jew, and if they do so, they become a martyr, they become a hero. And now when you have radical Islamists in Europe doing the same thing, well, people are starting to take note. But even in Europe, it's astounding, because for the longest time, as I say, the West has turned a blind eye to that Palestinian culture that encourages killing Jews. And now, even though it's happening in Europe, There's more than a few in Europe that are turning a blind eye to that strategy or that tactic, or excusing that behavior, incredibly. It says here, this is from Commentary, the use of emotionally distressed recruits is an ideal way for terrorists to foster confusion about their aims, because it makes it even easier for well-meaning Westerners to reassure themselves that Islamist death cults, which exploit such distress to turn people into killers, aren't actually the problem. The real issue, they tell themselves, is mental health or social alienation. And so we make excuses for these blatant attacks against Jews or against Westerners, saying that, well, there must be some sort of social ill or mental health problem that's causing this. Certainly not a radical ideology. It says, second, the tactic helps divide the West and turn it against itself, because it reinforces another existing tendency of many well-meaning Westerners blaming the victim for having driven the attacker to such a dreadful deed. It says, Westerners have been blaming Palestinian terror on Israel for years, And now many are blaming themselves for ISIS. They've been blaming the Palestinian terror on Israel. This has been going on for years, as so many of you know. But now, astoundingly, here are many Europeans now blaming themselves for these attacks brought on by radical Islamists. A classic example of this tendency emerged the day after the attack in France in, I think it was November, the Bataclan Concert Hall. It says here that this reporter for Haaretz newspaper in Israel visited one of the neighborhoods where these attacks came from, and discovered there that the people, this is according to Haaretz, the people aren't angry, at least not at the perpetrators. And then to quote this piece from commentary, the terrorists are stupid, but they aren't evil, a woman who works at one of the district's theaters told him. They are victims. They're victims of a system that excluded them from society. That's why they felt this doesn't belong to them and they could attack. There are those who live here in alienation, and we are all to blame for this alienation. Here's a woman from the neighborhood where these attackers came from, justifying the attack, that horrific attack in November. 130 people gunned down, murdered, in multiple attacks, and saying that, well, it's our fault. We've alienated them. Some of the others blamed French or American foreign policy, but this article says here, quoting Haaretz, no one wanted to talk about Islamists or the Islamic State, even after it took responsibility for the attacks. I mean, even after they say, yeah, we did it, no one wants to blame it on them. You think about the Obama administration, you know, not even wanting to say terrorist attack whenever possible. Certainly to not imply that radical Islam had anything to do with it. You see the same attitudes of appeasement and weakness in Europe too. It says some of the others blame French or American foreign policy, but no one wanted to talk about the Islamists or the Islamic State. It says, it's hard to find anyone at this gathering who would say a bad word about the attackers. That's quoting from the Haaretz piece in Israel, but this is from Commentary magazine. And then Commentary says, using assailants with a history of mental or emotional problems is an ideal way for terrorists to reinforce this tendency as well, because it enables people to focus on the assailant's distress and society's failure to deal with it, rather than on the evil intent of those who incited him to kill by telling him he would thereby become a hero instead of a loser. He's a hero, you see. He's a martyr. That's what the leaders in ISIS are telling these lone wolves to do. Well, you do this and you'll be a hero. It says, yet both gambits are working for ISIS now precisely because Westerners are conditioned, or rather were conditioned for decades, to believe them. By the way, their own journalists, academics, and political leaders insistently treated Palestinian terror as Israel's fault. You see all these apologists in the major media who are so quick to say, well, it's Israel's fault, or well, it's Europe's fault. Or in the case of the violence in America's cities, well, it's the fact that there's so much poverty in these inner cities that's driving these young black men to lash out at law enforcement. Someone else is to blame. It's never the perpetrator. It's never the one that actually carries out these atrocities. This piece here from the Daily Beast, well, you can see from the last one I just went through, there's a strategy there to take advantage of some of those who are loners and perhaps disturbed and disgruntled, and to get them to lash out at any Westerner, kill a Westerner. But as this Daily Beast piece points out, some of them are more specifically directed to kill Christians. You know where this is leading. Think about this first paragraph. It says the so-called Islamic State has different strategies in different parts of the world, but in Africa and in Europe, certainly its core objective is becoming clear: to kill Christians. So it's not even so much a Westerner in general, but to look for and to kill Christians, like in northern France, in Normandy, with that priest from a few weeks back. And then this: it's a long-term goal to provoke a new crusade, reviving the holy wars of many hundreds of years ago, in the belief that this time around, Islam will win. They're trying to provoke a holy war, even as so many people in Europe, in the news media, in the United States, are turning a blind eye to the motive, to the strategy here. You know, of course, it's building to Daniel 11:40. How much longer will the West turn a blind eye to this coming clash? And you think about that word in Daniel 11:40, push. They're pushing. Its long-term goal, to provoke a new crusade. I mean, they think this time they can win. They're not going to. But they think this time they can win. They believe it. They're reviving the holy wars of old. The clash is coming. You think about the mind change of this Daniel 8 man that we talk about often. He comes into power by flatteries, and then, as the prophecies bring out, there's a mind change. His eyes are opened, you could say. I mean, there's going to be a mind change all across Europe as people finally awaken to the fact that, okay, this is a holy war. Forget about what we thought before, that he was disturbed, or he was disadvantaged, or he was poor. It was because of poverty. Finally, Europe will wake up, and it leads to that Daniel 11:40 clash. This one here, to talk more specifically now about London. It's an interesting piece from the Daily Beast also. The British female fighters of ISIS and the changing face of London. As I said, it's something even a few of us noticed just last week as we took time out at the end of the day to eat there at Hyde Park. There's a lot of people there enjoying the park that, they just don't look like what the people there would have looked like 20, 30, 40 years ago. Certainly not a century or two ago. Britain is changing, and you can see it on the streets of London. You can see it. You can see it all over, but in particular, within London. It says a 17-year-old ISIS volunteer, Khadija Sultana, was killed by a Russian bombing strike in Syria, according to the BBC. One extraordinary thing about her is that she was already, at her age, a widow. 17 years old, and she was a widow because she was married to an ISIS fighter who had been killed. It says what brought her to the attention of the BBC is that she was from Bethnal Green, in the heart of London's historically Cockney East End. It says within the memory of, say, someone who went to London for graduate school in 1966, romantics could still think of Bethnal Green as a backwater of Dickensian proles who picked pockets, sold vegetables out on the barrows, and sang garrulous songs about booze and adultery. It says, today's London's Cockney East End is London's Muslim East End. It says 38% of the population of Bethnal Green is of Bangladeshi background, including the late Sultana's family, this gal that was taken out in a bombing strike. It says in February of 2015, she boarded a flight to Turkey with two of her Muslim school chums in hopes of waging jihad. I mean, this made big news a little over a year ago. One of these three girls, teenagers, boarded a flight to Turkey, 15, 16 years of age. And in this case, she ends up married. And then she's a widow by the age of 17. It says the network ITV reported on its website three heartbroken families were left behind. That's how it was reported last year when those three girls left They got up and left. They disappeared. They turned up in Turkey. And then from there went into Syria. And they joined the fight. They joined up with ISIS. And ITV says, oh, well, their family's here in London. Just heartbroken. Heartbroken. Over the loss of their daughters. But as this Daily Beast article brings out, are we sure of that? I mean, do we really know that their families were heartbroken? They will certainly have been nervous about their fates or the fates of their daughters. But whether they were heartbroken depends on how they feel about Islamism. In such neighborhoods, there is still a full range of opinions on such matters. Those Muslim neighborhoods in London are growing, as it says here. You think about the average student in 1966. Returning to that same neighborhood today, where 38% of the population comes from Bangladesh, including the family of one of these gals that was killed by a bombing strike. Are we really certain that their families are heartbroken? For all we know, I mean, they may have encouraged it. Or maybe privately, at least, sympathized with the cause. Well, this piece here, this comes from the New York Times, talking again about the migrant crisis in Europe. As I said, it's not getting as many headlines right now as it did a few months back, or certainly not as it did at the end of last year. But it's still an ongoing crisis. Richard Palmer talked about it some on Trumpet Hour last Friday. But it says here, a year after the world was riveted by scenes of desperate men, women, and children streaming through Europe, international attention to their plight has waned now that the borders have been closed and they are largely confined to camps. It says anti-immigrant sentiment has surged since last year in many countries, especially as people who entered Europe with the migrant flow are linked to crimes and, in a few cases, attacks planned or inspired by the Islamic State or other radical groups. And so the flow of migrants, it has slowed down some. But again, think of the 1.2, 1.3 million that are already there. And each time there's an attack or each time they're linked to crime, you can see that this is just an open wound that's not going to go away. It says neither the prosperous nations of Western and Northern Europe, where the refugees want to settle, nor Turkey, their point of departure for the continent, are living up to their promises of help. And so it still is a crisis of epic proportions. It says that in visits to four camps around Greece, migrants already seared by conflict and poverty voiced common concerns about inadequate food and health care. And then further on, it says the ranks of those in limbo are most likely to grow despite a deal to resolve the crisis that took effect March 20th between the EU and Turkey. It says while the number of migrants entering Greece has dwindled from the nearly 5,000 a day last year, hundreds have started crossing the Aegean Sea again after the July 15 coup attempt in Turkey. I mean, there's just so many explosive hotspots. Now you have the coup in Turkey, or the attempted coup from mid-July. And so you have hundreds more, thousands more now trying to get out of Turkey. It's just as if these problems are never ending. And one dies out a little bit and then another one emerges. And that's just the way that it's been. I mean, these are the times we're living in. They're not going away, these crises. And it will, as I said a moment ago, it will lead to dramatic changes in Europe, in Germany in particular, as that way is cleared for the Daniel 8-man to emerge, and then the mind change, and then the clash. This piece here from the Times of London about the alarm over President Obama's wish to ban first nuclear strikes. It says a proposal favored by President Obama for the U.S. to pledge never to use nuclear weapons first has alarmed allies amid fears it might further embolden a belligerent Russia. I mean, this is something the President of the United States, he hasn't yet made this decision, but he's pressing forward with it, even against the wishes of many of his own aides. And then the allies, amid concerns that it's going to embolden a belligerent Russia. And what about China? And what about Iran? And on it goes. I mean, you think about how many nations absolutely despise the United States. How many enemies the United States has in this dangerous world. And here is a president openly talking about, well, hey, we're going to dismantle our arsenal. That's our goal. That's our objective. And also, we're going to do away with this first strike. It's as if we're inviting enemies to attack. It's as if we're telling them, look, we're not going to attack you first, and if you do attack in this fashion or in that fashion, well, we won't respond, certainly, with nuclear weapons. I mean, why would you even say it? That's the thing. Why even say it? Well, because this particular leader, he believes the world's just getting better and better and more. You've heard all the quotes. We played the sound bites for you on this program. The world's safer now than ever before. It's a peaceful and tranquil world, to quote his spokesman there at the White House. And in fact, it's just a sign that children are the princes and that babes are ruling over Israel today. That's Isaiah 3 and verse 4. Well, as the article brings out, America's allies are, well, they're just shocked. What will this do to the alliance, the NATO alliance? It says here, British officials are believed to have made it known to the White House that they're deeply opposed, that's a direct quote, deeply opposed to any move by Mr. Obama to make a no first use declaration as part of his legacy. He leaves office in January, so he's out there legacy building these last 4 or 5 months, assuming he leaves office in January. I mean, look at this world. Look at what's happening in the United States. British officials are alarmed. Here they are, deeply opposed to any move such as this. It says critics say that it would be a radical and risky shift that would erode trust in the U.S., even as NATO confronts a newly aggressive Russia, and as Japan and South Korea maintain a close watch on a nuclear-armed and wildly unpredictable North Korea. I mean, that's the world in which the President of the United States says, yeah, well, we've got to take the lead in dismantling the arsenal. And also, I'd really like to consider a proposal that bans first nuclear strikes. It says the measure is thought to be one of a number of options being considered by the White House that could soften America's nuclear stance. Soften America's nuclear stance. Another would reduce the alert status of the Minuteman Intercontinental Missile Force based on U.S. soil. See, we'll dial everything down. That's the thinking. I mean, it's as if this administration believes that we're already in a Garden of Eden utopia. Nothing to worry about here. Let's just dismantle everything. Let's just roll back our defenses. That's the thinking. I mean, if you go back to May and that speech he gave in Hiroshima, the president talked there in that speech about all these modern advancements that we've seen in technology, that they need to be accompanied by a moral revolution. That's his words, a moral revolution. And then he proceeded to speak about a world that's getting better and better, as if this moral revolution is happening and we're getting better and holier and closer to God. In fact, the Bible says evil men and seducers will wax worse and worse. Back to this article, the Times of London says France, Japan, and South Korea have also voiced opposition to a no first use policy. Now, we talked about when we went through the Hiroshima speech how that really this is the United States just clearing the way for Japan to go after the nukes, for Japan to build up its army. That's what this actually triggers, a nuclear arms race. And yet President Obama believes that by rolling it back in the United States, that it'll lead to a world of peace. That's not what your Bible says will happen, though. We'll look at that here in just a second. It says, one European diplomat noted that a promise to not use nuclear weapons first against a nuclear-armed adversary would overturn NATO policy agreed as recently as last month at the Warsaw Summit. That's what we're talking about, too, the impact of this, overturning NATO policy. I mean, we've already talked about the soon-coming division between the United States and its NATO allies as Europe is left to go it alone, and it will go alone. We're already seeing the signs there of European nations upping their budgets for defense as they see a resurgent Russia, as they see Russian belligerents coming in from the east. It's happening right there in Ukraine. It says here, Mr. Obama faced fierce resistance from his own cabinet, including from Ashton Carter, the defense secretary, and John Kerry, the secretary of state, when the matter was discussed at a meeting of the National Security Council last month. However, no decision came out of the meeting, and Mr. Obama is said to be eager to burnish his legacy on nuclear nonproliferation in his last days in power. He is eager, never mind what his advisors say, he's eager to burnish his legacy. That's what this is about. It says the White House yesterday declined to rule out the possibility of a no-first-use policy, according to a spokesman. He said that Mr. Obama remained committed to a, quote, trajectory to place us on the path to a world without nuclear weapons. Now, that's something that this president stated as one of his first goals coming into office back in 2009.
As a nuclear power, as the only nuclear power to have used a nuclear weapon, the United States has a moral responsibility to act.
The U.S. has a moral responsibility to act and to take the lead. That's what the president was getting at back in 2009. His spokesman yesterday said, we're always looking for additional ways to achieve progress on the president's path forward while maintaining a credible deterrent for the United States, our allies, and partners. But this is not a credible deterrent. Not when you come out and say, look, we're not going to use them as a first strike. We won't do that. And what is that? What message does that send to America's enemies? The article says here, critics of no first use say that it would embolden America's enemies and antagonize allies. That's actually what's happening already. As Britain is alarmed, France is alarmed, Japan is alarmed, South Korea is alarmed. And America's enemies are emboldened. It says analysts fear that a switch could prompt Japan and South Korea to start their own covert nuclear weapon programs. Really? So the U.S. dismantles and then all these other nations build up a nuclear arsenal. Says Shinzo Abe, the Japanese prime minister, is understood to have communicated his concerns to Harry Harris Jr., the admiral who leads the U.S. Pacific Command. So you have all these world leaders sending in their complaints. Surely you're not going to make this policy change. Surely you can't do this. Surely this is not going to help make it a more peaceful world. President Obama moves forward. This is the way to peace. This is the way to utopia. NATO allies were alarmed last year when Russia threatened to use nuclear force to retain Crimea. That's the world. That's the real world. A world where the President of the United States is announcing we won't use nuclear force, and Russia is saying we will use it over Crimea if we have to. Do you think there's a need for a strong deterrent in a world like the one we live in today? And furthermore, what does your Bible say? What does your Bible prophesy for these latter days? I'll look at that in just a second. The article says Mr. Obama has been fascinated with nuclear weapons policy since his days as a student. He's been interested in this since he was a college student. It says during the Iran nuclear deal negotiations, he plunged into technical details so deeply that some of his aides questioned whether it represented the best use of the president's time. I mean, this is his baby. This is his baby. He's been interested in a nuclear-free world since his days as a college student, and he got right into the fine print with the Iran nuclear deal. He believes the world's getting safer. He believes, and he talked about it. It's not like it's a huge surprise, as I say. He gave us insight into it in that 2009 speech in Prague.
First, the United States will take concrete steps towards a world without nuclear weapons. To put an end to Cold War thinking, we will reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy and urge others to do the same.
And that's what he's doing. And this is, I mean, this pledge that he made in 2009, and this helped him win the Nobel Peace Prize. The Norwegian Nobel Committee. It stated that it awarded President Obama the Peace Prize for, quote, his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples. The committee has attached special importance to Obama's vision of and work for a world without nuclear weapons. Well, he's winning prizes. He's winning awards for bringing peace. And with each passing day, the world becomes more and more dangerous. So much so that last year, Russia threatened to use nuclear weapons. In this article, again, the Times of London, it says the White House remains committed to that promise as Mr. Obama, the one from Prague, as Mr. Obama enters the twilight phase of his presidency, he's said to be keen to present new measures when he makes his final appearance as president at the UN Security Council next month. And so we'll be watching it closely, the build up to the UN Security Council meeting with the president giving his final speech. It says Mr. Obama laid the groundwork for renouncing the right to use the right to first use, sorry, in Prague in one of the earliest speeches of his presidency, where he pledged to work for a nuclear weapons free world. Here again is what the president had to say in 2009.
The basic bargain is sound. Countries with nuclear weapons will move towards disarmament. Countries without nuclear weapons will not acquire them, and all countries can access peaceful nuclear energy.
It's a basic bargain, and it's sound in its reasoning. Countries with nuclear weapons will disarm, and countries that don't have nuclear weapons won't acquire them, and everyone will seek peaceful nuclear energy. Simple as that. But what does your Bible say? I mean, disarmament is coming. Prophecies say that they'll turn their swords into plowshares. There will be a worldwide disarmament. But it's going to be imposed upon the nations of this world by the government of God. That's who's bringing peace to this world. That's who will build a Garden of Eden utopia. But the Bible says before that, this world will have to endure another nuclear war. Look at verses like Amos 5 and verse 3, where it talks about the city that went out by 1,000 shall leave 100, and that which went forth by 100 shall leave 10. 10 left in the city of 1,000. You know about the prophecy of Jesus Christ. There in Matthew 24, then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be, and except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive. But God's going to cut it short. And then finally, disarm the nations of this world and bring peace to this world. But before that, nuclear weapons by the hundreds, perhaps by the thousands, they will be used again. Your Bible says so. It's going to be so much worse than what happened there at the end of World War II. I mean, at that time, there was only one nation that had the bomb. the United States. Today, what do you have? 9 or 10 countries, I think it is, that control something like 16,000 nuclear weapons. And so many of those bombs are so much more powerful than what America dropped on Japan 70 years ago. In fact, President Obama's quest for a nuclear-free world, a nuke-free world, it's actually accelerating the fulfillment of these prophecies in Matthew 24 and Amos 5. That's what your Bible says. One last story here about this current administration in the United States. The news from yesterday of the 15 Guantanamo detainees that are going to be let go, set free. The Pentagon made the announcement yesterday. They're off to the United Arab Emirates. And it brings the total number of prisoners down to 61 now at Guantanamo. 61. It says the Obama administration has made a sustained diplomatic push to persuade Persian Gulf states to resettle detainees from troubled countries like Yemen. American security officials see them as attractive places to send such detainees, both because they share the same language and culture and so on, these Persian Gulf states. And so they're being spread about in countries like the UAE. But it says here, when Mr. Obama took office in 2009, 242 detainees remained at Guantanamo. And of course, you'll recall his initial or first promises from that year, 2009. We just heard about what he believed about a nuclear-free world. And then he also had all those promises about closing Guantanamo. And of course, Congress is fighting him on this. And this piece in the New York Times suggests that it's going to be near impossible to close it entirely. But to go from 242 down to 61, I mean, and then knowing, like we covered yesterday, all that he's been willing to do to bypass Congress, to get around the Constitution, it'll be interesting to see. Fascinating to watch, for sure, what happens in these final months in this calendar year. 242. He's proposed closing it by bringing several dozen detainees who are not approved for transfer to a replacement prison on domestic soil. Of course, he's catching a lot of criticism for this. But, I mean, right now, Congress is not in session in the United States. It's a good time. It's a good time for the president to carry a lot of this out. And so here is an administration whose primary responsibility is to keep America safe, and he's removing the deterrent of a first strike policy, or at least he wants to. He's emptying out Guantanamo. 1 in 4 of the prisoners so far released from Guantanamo have returned to the battlefield. 1 in 4. So if we take that average of these 15, there's going to be 3 or 4 that head right back into the battle, that kill Westerners, that kill Jews, or kill Christians, or kill Europeans, or kill Americans. That's where 1 in 4 of them will head. As I say, I wouldn't put it past this particular administration to get to the end of this year and to have that prison shut down. He really is intent on burnishing his legacy, following through on his agenda. It's as if anything and everything that can be done to weaken the position of the United States abroad, like we read yesterday from my father's articles, and to amass more power at home. That's what's happening with greater speed and acceleration in these last months of 2016. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to send us those comments We love reading your emails. td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. One may blind his eyes to existing facts and trends and say the world cannot get any worse than it already is. Or, if we just ignore the conditions and don't worry, perhaps they'll go away. But these conditions and trends won't just go away. Not unless they are caused to go away. The scriptures of the Holy Bible, the inspired revelation of the Supreme God, have foretold today's world conditions and trends, and give us the advance news of coming peace on earth, of universal prosperity, of happiness and joy, of veritable utopia. This is the good news of the world tomorrow, and it is absolutely sure. This coming world is vividly described in our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. What it will be like. Bible prophecy explains in detail how God will intervene to save mankind from destroying himself. Jesus Christ will return to earth, putting an end to the rule of man and restore God's government on earth. To learn much more about this prophesied utopia, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
One of the things that we do when we bring young people into our youth camps, we just finished one on Sunday, as many of you know, but when they arrive at camp and they head off to their dorms with their counselors, they're told to turn in all of their gadgets, any phones that they might have or iPods or any kind of device that can get music, headphones. All of that's turned in, and for 2 weeks, although when we did, I will say we made an exception on the field trip, since most people now take pictures on their phones, we did hand back phones just for that day and then collected them upon our return to the campus. But for the most part, 2 weeks, they're free from all of that kind of influence, any kind of an influence from outside. And then they spend all kinds of time talking with each other, interacting with their counselors, interacting with educators, interacting with sports instructors, listening attentively to numerous lectures. 1 hour lectures, 1 hour and 15, an hour and a half, here and there, sprinkled throughout a very active 2 weeks, of course. Lots of sports, lots of dancing, lots of socializing, lots of fun, lots of learning. There's a huge emphasis on learning and education at this youth camp, as there always is at God's youth camp. We were there reminding these young people that they're in training. They're being educated. And as part of that education, travel is important, experiences, contacts that you make, lectures you hear, and also the materials that you read and study. We told them on the last day of camp, get a journal and write down your thoughts. We used historical examples like John Quincy Adams, and said, look, these were remarkable men of history because of how educated they were, because of how deep they were able to think, because of how well-read they were. It was a different time. Well, this piece here in The Spectator about the memory gap, it brought to mind all these things that we reinforce at youth camp and at college. Because it says here, what happens when we outsource part of our brains to the internet? The article basically is about just leaning on gadgets and the internet and phones. to do all of your thinking and research for you. This author says that, you know, I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday. I don't remember people's birthdays anymore. I don't need to know capital cities. I don't need to memorize phone numbers. Because all of that's just a push of a button away from my phone. He says here, I'm not alone. Many young people feel our memories have been shot to pieces. It's the embarrassing secret of my generation. We can hardly recall anything. We joke about having early onset Alzheimer's, often with a hint of real anxiety. We know that when we reach to remember any detail, a route, a phrase, a historical fact, our minds do not perform at the critical moment. So we reach instead for our phones, which are much more trustworthy. It's quite a crutch that too many of us are dependent on. It says here, every day, and increasingly in every way, we are outsourcing our brains to the internet, but at what cost? As smartphones get smarter, it's easy to argue that we're getting thicker. Our brains are not necessarily shriveling. They are adapting, though. Thanks to technology, the need to know has been replaced by the ability to find out. And so it goes on and points out how that expertise is being made redundant. It gives a few examples here of London's black cabbies who used to have it all in their heads. They knew how to get anywhere in London. They didn't need a phone. They didn't need a GPS. They didn't need a navigator. But now anyone and everyone can come along with this new app, Uber app, and become a taxi driver on their own. And it's eating into the business of the real experts. Because any old Joe with a phone can answer a request on Uber and become a taxi driver for that evening. No need for experts when you have phones that are so smart. Further on, it says here, what does that mean for education? University finals, where students rely on memory unaided, seem an anachronism. Once it was the perfect training for later life. Learn a subject, store the information, use it later to your career advantage. But when every fact is just a click or two away, what's the point? It says, I can at least still remember. I think he said he's, 26 years of age. This is a young man writing this. I can at least still remember what it used to be like to commit a fact to memory. You can take pride in it. It was a delicious, joyful thing, a gentle high. That has now been replaced by addictive, short, sharp bits of dopamine mixed with adrenaline. Who can search first? Who has the fastest fingers tapping away on their phone? It says the pleasure of contemplation has been replaced by the constant buzz of ephemera passing us by on Instagram, Facebook, and so on. Well, he goes on and says that there's evidence to suggest that our brains are changing or that they're being rewired to meet the demands of this modern world. It's a similar point that Nicholas Carr, I think his name is, that he brought out in his book, The Shallows. But later on in this piece from The Spectator, it says, but for all these obstacles, humanity has just become more ingenious. Well, I mean, it talks about, in one sense, it's not something to be alarmed over. There were those critics who said radio is a bad thing when that came on the scene, and then TV, of course, and then movies and music and whatnot, and how that through all of this, we've just been able to create even more incredible inventions like the internet. And so here you have the paradox, as we talked about quite often at this camp that we just concluded on Sunday. All of this technology, all of this modern advancement, all of this development, this progress, and the corresponding increase of evil division and strife. Well, just to finish this piece, he doesn't make the point as strongly as he could about how it is impacting education in a negative way, I mean. He kind of touches on it here and there, says that the problem's especially bad here in the UK. The UK had one of the worst rates. More than half of British adults admitted that they don't even try to remember answers. They just search online. And he says here, we're becoming a flabby-brained nation. It is having an impact. It is dumbing us down. It says here, what if instead of a nuclear strike, this is an interesting thought, what if instead of a nuclear strike or tsunami, an electromagnetic pulse wiped every hard drive, every detail of every bank account, every family photo, then what? History's littered with examples of knowledge being destroyed or damaged. Details about ancient Roman sanitation were lost for hundreds of years during the medieval period, the destruction of the Great Library of Alexandria. We assume that nothing is ever lost online, but that's not true. He goes on and gives some examples of that even today. But what about an electromagnetic pulse? It says further down, it may well be that memory is more spiritual than we like to admit. By using our minds, we nourish a part of us that goes beyond the physical. Equally, by storing memory outside of ourselves on a piece of technology, we lose something fundamental. And he concludes with this expert saying that we should get back to memorizing poetry and such, just as an exercise for the brain, for the mind. Well, coming back to this point, what does it mean for education? Here again, it was something that the theme that we built on at this camp. And as I say up front, we say, all right, turn in the gadgets. Let's just focus on what's being said. Let's just jot down notes. Let's get a journal. Let's record our thoughts. Let's learn how to think. Let's learn how to concentrate and meditate. That's really what this takes away from. Our ability to concentrate and to meditate and to just think deeply on things. Years ago at The Spectator, this is another Spectator piece, quite a lot older, from 2000, written by British historian Paul Johnson. He said, I have the impression as a historian that people are less intelligent than they used to be, and that this process has now been going on for a century or more. It is concealed by the myriad of age to knowledge. See, all the technology, all the advancement that's brought out in this man's piece at The Spectator, now the internet, now smartphones, it's concealing a big problem. And that is that we are less intelligent than we used to be. And that process has been ongoing now for more than a century. This is the dark side of technology. Now, we have to make use of it, and it can be used wisely, and it is amazing how much you can get to information so much quicker than it would have taken just a few years ago. I mean, just to follow on that example from the Art Museum and the British Museum that we visited last week, just being able to look on your phone at a piece of art that's there hanging on the wall and to see something about it, to learn some history about that particular painting, how much it's worth, when it was bought, you know, what it went for at the auction. Just interesting little details that you wouldn't necessarily have if you're not, you know, really into the classics of art. Same with the British Museum. But what is it doing to our educational system? What's it doing to our intelligence overall? There's a dark side to it for sure. We better make sure we know how to use it the right way, and we better make sure that we know when not to use it. When to set it aside, when to take it away, when to prevent our children from getting into it or getting into it too much. Johnson says here, the reasons for our decline in intelligence are many, but then can be summarized under the one head: lack of use of large parts of the brain. We're not using our minds. It's been a continuing process for well over a century, but it's now rapidly accelerating. in a lot of ways, this explains the paradox, doesn't it? The world isn't getting better. It's not becoming more peaceful. It's not less evil and violent than it used to be. We're steamrolling ahead. Nations are about to collide with one another. Nations are rearming. Nations are building up their nuclear arsenals. And then look at the state of education today. Look at the graduates. Universities are turning out. President Obama is a product of our modern educational system. And he was thinking about disarming the world of nuclear weapons back when he was in college. He has a view of the world that's very different from what the Bible describes. The present evil world, Paul said in Galatians 1. Now, utopia is coming, as I said in the first segment. God's bringing it to this earth. And think about how different all of the technologies of today will be used in the wonderful world of tomorrow. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with Stephen Fleury. Email us at td@kpcg.fm. That's all that we have time for today, but we thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again tomorrow.